On To The Point, we try to make sense of the policy debates and the political sideshows on the campaign trail.
Neither party's agenda really aligns with who its coalition is today.
It was the dumbest speech I have ever seen in my life of covering politics.
When people walk into a voting booth, at the end of the day, they do say, I really should vote for someone smarter than me.
I'm Warren Altney. To The Point has you covered for the 2016 campaign. Find the To The Point podcast on KCRW's iTunes page.
Trump is for America, and I live in America, and I'm American.
He's doing something right if the establishment hates him.
I think he is a true patriot, and I think Obama has been apologizing for America being America for too long.
We need somebody that doesn't have a vested interest in lining their pockets.
I really think he will bring back the job.
The American people are getting screwed here, and if we don't do something about it, it's going to get worse. It's not going to get any better.
Voices from Donald Trump rallies in Arizona over the weekend. As Arizonans prepare to vote in their primary tomorrow, we'll get the scene on the ground. But first, President Obama gave a historic speech today from Havana.
I've said consistently, after more than five very difficult decades, the relationship between our governments will not be transformed overnight. We continue, as President Castro indicated, to have some very serious differences, including on democracy and human rights. And President Castro and I have had very frank and candid conversations on these subjects.
President Obama's trip to Cuba is the first by a sitting president in nearly 90 years. Calvin Coolidge was the last U.S. president to visit the island back in 1928. Talks between Obama and Cuban leader Raul Castro are expected to tackle human rights issues, trade, and economic reforms. And one industry keeping a close watch on these talks, Hollywood. No major film studio has shot a film in Cuba since the embargo slammed the door shut in the 1960s. But with a thawing of relations, studios are starting to sniff around the island. The director of the next Fast and Furious movie has already started pre-production there. Joining me now from Cuba is Ed Rivero. He's the executive producer of Shoot Cuba. That's a production company based in Havana. Welcome.
Thank you. Great to be on.
So do you think that this is going to be the first of a lot of big productions there?
I think so. House of Lies shot in December, which is a TV show.
And so is the infrastructure in place there to accommodate all these productions now seeking interest?
I mean that's one of the things that I'm really interested in, being that the fact that I am actually Cuban, is to help build that infrastructure and bring it at a higher level. Obviously, it's only one or two or three crews deep, mm-hmm. and that's the challenge, is to come here and train more people in order to do these things.
Train Cubans?
Not training them in the filmmaking aspect of it, but training them how the rest of the world works. You know, they have an incredible film school here, so you have a lot of people that have the aesthetics. They just need to know how to, they're making the transition from artistic filmmaking to commerce.
Mm.
And that's the difference.
Can you give me an example of what they need to learn?
A lot of countries, Spain, Cuba, they don't use script supervisors. That's a position that's never existed here. They have someone who's called continuity, but that's a position that we're actually going to have to teach and train some people to do. Initially, we'll probably have to bring them, probably from Mexico or maybe Puerto Rico, until we get them up to speed. But they have like all the technical stuff, lighting, camera, all that's here. There's a very rich community of filmmakers here. It's just a specific process of those positions. That's where the training comes in. And then the sheer number of people in order to have to do multiple projects, which is the challenge right now. You get three or four huge projects here, the town's pretty locked in then.
Yeah. So do you think that American production companies would just fly in a lot of their workers and talent instead?
I think initially they probably will. I mean, I think there's some hesitancy to that just because, you want to use as many of the local people as possible. There's also a cost of bringing people here.
Mm-hmm.
But most of the people that I've talked to, they know that there's a base crew here. So that you don't need to bring all the technicians. You just need to bring maybe an art director, maybe a wardrobe stylist, a script supervisor. Very specific roles. Overall, I think unlike some countries where you have to bring everyone, I think in this country maybe 30% of the crew is not here, which is not too bad.
Is there a problem with the language barrier?
You know, there is, but I think, you know, if you're going to go shoot to Cuba, you got to understand that, you know, you're shooting in Cuba.
Yeah.
You know, is there a language barrier in Mexico and Argentina and South Africa? Yeah. But obviously, that's another area of training. It's making sure we get, you know, younger people who are completely bilingual in the film business, besides being translators, but actually learning positions so they have more value to it.
So who's interested in shooting in Cuba, and what kinds of projects are they interested
Everybody.
In doing?
Everybody. Right now, we're bidding a couple commercials. There's a couple TV networks that have called us about possibly doing some type of programming, from home shopping, you know, home repair homes or architectural, there's a lot of architects here, to food specials. You know, Anthony Bourdain shot here 3 times, so the Food Network has a lot of interest in coming down here.
And you have the Fast and Furious movie that is shooting there.
Yeah.
Is that the biggest by far?
I think right now that's the biggest by far. You know, up until September of last year, you know, obviously we couldn't come here to shoot.
How has it been to accommodate them as they do pre-production? Can you accommodate them?
You can accommodate, you know, like I said, it's only 3 deep. So if you know, like this, in every place, like Miami has an A crew. Maybe Miami has 6 A crews, and then you go to B and C. Mm-hmm. There's really only 1 A crew here, so if a show like The Fast and the Furious comes, they take all the top people. And all those top people are completely bilingual. The question is when you go into second tier and third tier, and that's the challenge. The challenge is the top project is going to get the top talent until we start addressing this and training. And you know, a lot of it is just experience.
How has the Cuban government reacted to this in terms of smoothing the road for you with filmmakers from abroad, from America?
Like, the Fast and the Furious is actually being done directly with the Film Commission in Cuba.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, our company's a private company, so they went directly because of just the sheer size of it. So, you know, they made it happen. There was an interest, and they made it happen, and they went directly to the government.
So is the government showing a lot of interest in having Hollywood film
there?
Oh, yeah.
They made this happen. They made it happen, and with a lot of interest, and they know this is going to open up a lot of other projects.
Is that new, that they're interested in this?
Well, with the U.S.
I mean, yeah.
You know, they've always done it with Europe and with France and Italy, but this is for the U.S., yeah. A lot of TV movies were always done here for Canada, France, Germany,
mm-hmm.
You know, and several theatrical films, but this is the first time that this is a Hollywood movie. You know, they haven't done a Hollywood movie here since the 50s.
Wow. What does this mean for your company? Where do you see this going?
I see it's going. I mean, it's gonna. I mean, this is my dream. I've been on this for like 15 years. I came here in 2001. I was invited to the film festival, and I just said, okay, I'm Cuban. I'm from here. I left when I was 5 years old. I'm not the only, but I'm one of the only guys in Hollywood that's actually Cuban. And I think it's gonna open up from production values, also from stories. There's a lot of stories to be told here that no one's seen. I think we're getting a lot of interest. You know, I know Netflix is looking at Cuba. Amazon, you know, I think there's a lot of content, you know, that's here that hasn't been exposed. So it's like real virgin territory, and that's hard to find.
Ed Rivero, co-founder of Shoot Cuba. That's a production company based in Havana. Ed, thank you.
Thank you.
Also on President Obama's to-do list while he's in Cuba, catch a baseball game. He's expected to attend tomorrow's exhibition game between the Tampa Bay Rays and the Cuban national team. The thawing of relations between the two countries could signal a new era for America's favorite pastime. For decades, baseball players like the Dodgers' Yasiel Puig have had to defect from Cuba just to find a professional career in the United States. So how would these renewed relations change all that? Here to tell us is Pete Bjarkman. He's the author of Cuba's Baseball Defectors, The Inside Story. Welcome to the program.
Well, I'm glad to be here, and thank you for having me.
My pleasure. Well, when the U.S. and Cuba first cut ties back in the 60s, what did baseball look like in Cuba?
Well, there was a professional winter league in Cuba throughout the first half of the 20th century. It really didn't become affiliated with Major League Baseball until the late 40s. And then through the 50s, you had regular winter league seasons there involving minor league and major league players from up north, just like you continue to have in the Dominican Republic or in Venezuela or in Puerto Rico, for example.
And how did it change after the embargo?
Well, after... Fidel came to power in 1959, and there was one more winter professional season played there, actually, 1960-61. Then baseball commissioner Ford Frick at that time suspended U.S. players going to Cuba because of the political unrest in the first couple of years of the Castro administration. And also the minor league team that was there in Havana was pulled out and relocated in Jersey City. At that point, Fidel basically nationalized Cuban sport as he nationalized other industries. Professional baseball was outlawed, a national league, countrywide national league, which they call their National Series, started in 1962. And then over the last half century and more, Cuba has built a great reputation as a powerhouse in international tournament play. The national team has kind of represented the image of Cuba, and those players are all drawn from their National Series.
Now, Castro famously called it slave baseball, the buying and selling of players.
Major League Baseball, yes, yeah. Or professional baseball outside of Cuba. Their idea there was that as part of the revolution, as part of their revolutionary society, that the dedication of athletes, particularly baseball players, because that was the national game in Cuba, should be to representing the flag, representing their country, playing for their provinces, not playing for financial reward. The league was entirely owned by the government. The different teams represented the different provinces. Players played within their own province. So there was no trading of players from one franchise to the other. There was no franchises. And so it was a very different flavor to the baseball in Cuba.
And you talk about quite a number of Cuban players who decided to defect to the United States. Who was the first person to do that?
Well, technically the first one was back in 1980 when Barbaro Garbay came as part of the Mariel boatlift. But really, the first of the current wave of defectors started in the early 1990s with Rene Arocha, a pitching star in 1991, and then the better-known Hernandez brothers, El Duque Hernandez and Levon Hernandez, who came in the late 1990s. But the defection started to explode after 2010 with Aroldis Chapman first signing a $30 million contract with the Cincinnati Reds. And then the last couple of years, you mentioned Puig in Los Angeles and Abreu with the White Sox and Yoenis Cespedes, who's a big star with the New York Mets now. And so these Cuban players that have defected have now become very visible over the last couple of years.
Why just in 2010? Why was that the year when this became allowed?
Well, you know, it's an interesting transition that's taken place. Up until the late 1990s, in Cuba, the goal for any young ball player in Cuba was to simply to play for the national team. They were quite isolated from the United States. They didn't have North American baseball on television in Cuba. But the national team, they were like rock stars in Cuba. They won all these international tournaments. And this is the goal that the players shot for. But then after 1999, things started to change because Major League Baseball began to allow its players to play in international, what had been international amateur tournaments before that, like the Olympics or the Pan Am Games. When professional players began to enter those tournaments, Cuba didn't dominate the way they had before. They were still strong, but they weren't dominant. And in recent years, they've slid from being the number one ranked team in international play down to now, in the current ratings, number five. And so when players like for example, Chapman in 2010 was able to get a $30 million contract in the major leagues, all of a sudden the fans in Cuba, their focus was on the players who had left. Those players had always been branded traitors by the Cuban government, but for the fans, suddenly they became the real heroes, much more so than the national team players who stayed at home. So you go to Havana. Now, I was there. I did the first Anthony Bourdain show down there in No Reservations, Cuba. And he wanted to, Bourdain wanted to talk to the players, to the fans in the Central Park and ask them about Cuban baseball. All they wanted to talk about was the guys that were in the major leagues because they take great pride in how those players represent Cuba.
Hmm. So last week, the Obama administration said that it will allow Cuban citizens to work in the United States. So would that mean the end of defections from Cuba?
I don't think so. In the short run, it may actually increase them. What that new policy does is it gets around the Treasury Department embargo, which doesn't allow Cuban citizens to be paid directly in the United States. The idea being that the money would not go back to Cuba. this new regulation, which now allows major league teams to sign players directly once they're in the United States, affects those players who've already defected, like the Gurriel brothers who are now in Miami, who defected about a month and a half ago. It doesn't do anything to change the Cuban government's position on not wanting to let their players leave legally. So right now, this is maybe even more pressure on some of the young Cuban players to try to get out of Cuba, be smuggled out of there maybe by human traffickers, get into Mexico, walk across the border, and they have in their mind they can all sign for millions of dollars. Of course, it's only a small handful that will ever attract that kind of a contract from Major League Baseball.
Right. And so Cuba is not necessarily going to be on board with this.
Well, this is the question. The Major League Baseball has a clear interest in trying to get access into Cuba from, I think, two standpoints. First of all, the idea of the Cuban talent, which has over the years been demonstrated. There's a lot of great players there, and they'd like to have the same kind of access to those players that they have to players, let's say, in the Dominican Republic or in Venezuela. They also, I think, in the long run, are thinking about this being a great baseball country, Cuba, that they could eventually, if they have Cubans playing in the major leagues in greater numbers, it would be a great market to sell memorabilia, to sell Los Angeles Dodgers caps or whatever. So they see a financial stake in Cuba. The Cuban government, on the other hand, is trying to hold its national baseball in place, but they're losing this battle. They, just like all things with the Cuban economy, it's very difficult for them now to stay afloat in an international capitalist world. They don't have a way to stop the defections. They're going to have to probably arrange some kind of an agreement with Major League Baseball. But what they don't want to do is simply open the doors, let the Major League teams come in, build academies there, sign up all the young teenage players, and basically strip all the talent off the island and leave them no baseball at home, no strong national team.
All right. Fascinating.
I would suspect that... Okay, great.
Sorry, we run out of time. Pete Bjorkman, author of the book, Cuba's Baseball Defectors, The Inside Story. The book is due out in May. Pete, thank you so much for joining us.
Great to talk to you.
And we'd love to hear from you. Do you think it's a good idea to open up relations with Cuba? We were talking about Hollywood and Major League Baseball. What do you think about their plans for the island? Give us a call, 1-844-PRESS-PLAY, or you can tweet us at KCRW-PRESS-PLAY. Coming up, violence is now a regular occurrence at Donald Trump rallies. We'll talk to our correspondent who was in Arizona over the weekend, and we'll talk about the relationship between Trump and the media. That's all coming up on Press Play.
This podcast is produced by KCRW. Find all of KCRW's music, storytelling, cultural, and news podcasts on our iTunes page.
You're listening to Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Utah, Idaho, and Arizona go to the polls tomorrow. Donald Trump is eyeing Arizona in particular, which has 58 winner-take-all delegates. The GOP frontrunner showed up there for two rallies this past weekend in Tucson and Phoenix, and Mike Schlitt could not stay away. He is a Press Play regular and a lifelong political junkie who's been reporting from the campaign trail for us from time to time. Hi, Mike.
Hello, Madeline.
So you have been watching the news. You've seen how these rallies unfold with, a fair amount of protests and violence.
Yep.
Were you a little apprehensive?
I was and I wasn't. I'm sort of like drawn to it like a moth to the flame. And I was careful. Everybody told me be careful. So.
Okay, you were careful, but you wanted to go. Why did you want to go so badly?
Well, first of all, my whole interest in the campaign is I'm more interested in what's going on in the minds of voters than I am in hearing what the candidates have to say. And Trump in particular I've been trying to avoid because there is just so much hoopla surrounding the guy and, you know, the media can't take their eyes off of him. And I just didn't want to contribute to any of the white noise. But there's now a sense of inevitability to his nomination, and I think the nation has gotten swept up in this phenomenon that I like to call, and I'm thinking about registering it, Trump fever.
You're going to register that as a trademark?
Yes, maybe I can make a little money on this thing.
How Trumpian of you.
Yes, exactly, following the man's lead.
But you're talking about both sides.
Absolutely. Let me tell you my definition of Trump fever, and it does apply to both Trump supporters and detractors, as well as people in the media and people on the inside of politics. Trump fever is a contagious, abnormal condition of the body politic which causes an undue rise in temperature, quickening of the pulse, disturbance of various body functions. It can incite delirium and or loss of all cognitive abilities and is often a symptom of another ailment or disease. That is my definition of Trump fever.
Okay, I think we all have a touch of it.
Yes,
sure.
We've all been touched by it in one way or another.
Right. Okay, so where did you go first?
First thing I did, I headed to a rally which was just outside of Phoenix in Fountain Park, which is in a very affluent suburban community, and I get in my rent-a-car, and I'm not on the highway for more than 30 seconds when I notice a guy driving by me in on a Harley-Davidson, and he's got a holstered gun strapped to his belt, and I realize that I am not in Eagle Rock, California anymore.
No.
And I'm not going to, you know, I don't know if this guy has Trump fever. It didn't look like he was going to the rally, but I did learn about open carry gun laws in Arizona being a lot more lenient than they are here. So he drove away, and I get to Fountain Park, and right outside I notice there's about 30 protesters, and I'm there a couple hours early because I wanted to talk to people. So there were definitely a lot of Trump detractors there. I'd say about, you know, maybe there were 2,000 people at the rally itself, maybe more. And I'd say about 15% of them were Trump protesters. But, you know, it's late morning. It's more of a picnic park environment than the actual, you know, rallies, indoor rallies where we've seen all the violence. It felt more festive than dangerous to me.
And what did the protesters say to you?
A variety of things. There was a Marine sergeant there who was talking about Trump's statements about bombing non-combatants and how he thought that was wrong. There were a lot of people talking about, you know, stamping out hate, a lot of the protesters. There were three college students I met who were wearing F Trump T-shirts.
Mm-hmm.
And we were talking, and then others started joining the conversation.
Trump, I believe, violates just basic human dignity. I mean, you can't go and tell somebody it's okay to punch somebody in your face because you disagree with them. It's not right. I don't hate Trump supporters, because hate's a strong word.
I don't think there's hate here. There's not from me. I came to see Mr. Trump. I really don't think he hates. I really think all these people, this guy right there with the idiot T-shirt on, I don't understand that. So that's why I ask anyone that's holding a hate, I mean, there's no hate here.
So, yeah, it seems like we're having a very real, grounded, if not particularly illuminating political conversation. And then the subject gets on to Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders. This other guy shows up and starts talking.
Bernie Sanders couldn't run a hot dog stand if you gave him the hot dogs. He's that stupid. What was his first job? Mayor of Burlington. He lived in a shack. He had dirt on his floor with his wife. This guy's a piece of crap.
So while Trump is talking, I'm walking around looking for more interesting sights and sounds, and I see the very first people of color I've seen at the entire rally. It's two African-American anti-Trump protesters, and there's a guy wearing a Malcolm X T-shirt and a woman holding up a Stop Racism sign.
When we talk to Trump supporters and we ask them why do they support Trump, the only thing they can say is build a wall or get them out of here. I haven't had an educated conversation.
Racism sucks. Yes, I agree. You know what? You know what's great here? 100% of the people at this rally hate Nazism.
So who's that guy?
It was a Trump supporter who just wanted to chime in and have his voice be heard and you know, actually take these protesters to task. And it started getting ugly very fast.
Say that. You're lying. When you stop lying, we can have a conversation.
You're implying that I'm a racist just because I'm wearing a Malcolm X.
I try to get in the middle of the conversation, try to get things to calm down a little bit. And I do think I was able to diffuse the tension a little bit. The conversation got less loud and a little less talking, a little more listening. Things started to get a little bit better.
I'm going to breathe.
Okay. How about asking this guy what he thinks instead of telling him what he thinks?
I'm still breathing.
So you're not interested in having a dialogue? You just
I'm
want to
interested
tell him
in breathing before I say anything else. This guy needed to calm down. I needed to calm down.
Okay.
This sweet, beautiful lady right here, which, is that a Michael Jackson hat? That is awesome. I really appreciate your hat. I love that. Where did you get that?
So
Michael Jackson heals all wounds.
Yes, for better and worse. It's a that needs no commentary there. They end up shaking hands. They have an awkward entente, and I feel like, okay, I brought two people with disparate points of view together. My work here is done. I'm going to Tucson.
So how is Tucson?
Tucson is a little bit different. It's an indoor rally at the Tucson Convention Center, and there's obviously more people. There are a lot of protesters outside the building, probably a couple hundred of them. And this time the mood is a lot hotter, a lot angrier, a lot louder, a lot of name-calling, incendiary language on both sides. And what's happening is there's a bunch of protesters outside, and all the people, Trump supporters, I assume they're all Trump supporters, are going into the convention center, and they have to walk through this gauntlet of protesters who are waving signs at them and screaming at them. And I thought I would talk to some protesters before I went inside. But then the tone and the language started to change, and the chanting got a little bit louder.
Shut it down! Shut it down!
Yeah, and the situation is very, very tense. And what I realize now is that the doors are closed. All the people are inside the convention center, and the police are blocking the doors to the entrance. And I realize I may not get in again. So I rush up to the front of the line, being very, very careful. As I said, I'm careful in this event. And I show the police my ticket, my press pass, and, of course, no, it's too late. The doors are locked. I have missed my second rally in one day.
Oh, no.
Yeah. But again, I think that's part of the Trump fever madness. And I heard from a number of people that Trump made a big thing about this, that because of the protesters, I think he said 2,500 people could not get in. That did not jibe with my count, but there were definitely quite a few of us who got locked out. So I decided to talk to protesters instead and trust that Trump said the same thing he's been saying every time. And again, what I experienced from talking to protesters is a lot of anger, a lot of fear, a lot of incendiary language on both sides of the fence. And I think what's happening here is people are getting a little crazier. You know, the cauldron is bubbling up, and it's a little scary, and I am a little genuinely concerned about what may happen in the future as this campaign keeps going on. Fortunately, I did talk to one woman outside the rally who was truly a breath of fresh air.
It's been a really fun experience outside. Everyone's coming together and voicing their First Amendment right of free speech, and everyone's being very peaceful. My sign says, "Marry me, Trump, make me legal." And I just more trying to make a statement that immigration's okay with Trump as long as they're a hot chick with big boobs. I'm basically just trying to be ironic. And
I think the subtlety.
I'm gonna be in your face till you die.
And there you have it.
What happened there at the end?
Well, two guys, a Trump, and I don't know, you know, as often happens in melees, it's hard to know what's going on, but two guys just started screaming at each other and fists flailing, and the police immediately rushed in there and broke it up.
As this woman was talking to you?
As she was talking to me.
About
as we
the
were
peaceful
discussing,
atmosphere.
Yes, as we were discussing subtlety, nuance, and irony, A fist fight broke out. The second one I saw that day, by the way. Trump fever.
Wow. You had a front row seat to that. Mike Schlitt will continue to travel across the country throughout the presidential campaign, and you can follow his adventures at MikeSchlitt.com. Mike, thank you.
Thank you, Madeline.
Coming up, the reporters who are granted access to these Trump rallies. They're called disgusting by the candidate sometimes, but their news organizations can't seem to get enough of him. And speaking of TV,
if you pick the right people, you know, you get a certain number of people who just want to kind of see what it looks like to see Geraldo Rivera dancing.
Dancing with the Stars is back. Our TV roundup is also coming up next on Press Play.
Subscribe to KCRW's Today's Top Tune Download Podcast to receive a free song of the day. Find Today's Top Tune on KCRW's iTunes page.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Donald Trump's presidential campaign is unconventional in many ways. His extremely antagonistic relationship with the press is one way. Here he is last week in Florida talking about the difficulties of campaigning.
Lies, deceit, viciousness, disgusting reporters, horrible people. Sure. Some are nice. Some are nice. Some really disgusting people back there, though, I have to tell.
Trump has publicly trashed journalists. He has feuded with Fox News' Megyn Kelly. He's banned papers like the New York Times from his events. Yet for all the animosity, Trump and the press are locked in a codependent dance. And here to discuss that are Ben Schreckinger, reporter for Politico. He's been on the Trump campaign trail. Hi, Ben.
Hi, how are you?
Great, thanks. And Jim Rutenberg, media columnist for the New York Times, is here. Hi.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Great to have you. Okay, Ben, let's start with you. You were banned from the speech we just heard a clip from. What happened?
So I was issued credentials that morning for the event. A few minutes later, I got an email saying that I was being denied credentials. I sought clarification from the campaign. They said, no, that was just a systems error. Don't worry, you're good. When I showed up, they let me onto the property because I was on one list and then I wasn't on another, and they kicked me out. And whether this is a coincidence or not, I had co-authored a pretty tough piece about the campaign manager that had come out earlier that morning.
Corey Lewandowski.
Yes, that's right.
Right. Who has been accused of roughing up another reporter?
Yes, that's right.
So the Trump camp basically treated your story like a smear, but it was a straightforward story, right? You talked to many sources?
Yes, absolutely. And for context, they had, at various points in the couple of weeks leading up to that, not issued me credentials, issued them at the last minute after fielding protests from my editors. And so that was the first event at which issues with credentials had actually been what kept me from covering an event, but there had been issues leading up to that as well.
Mm. Jim, let's turn to you now. Ben is not the only one to be banned. Trump has banned the Des Moines Register. He's banned your paper, the New York Times. He's banned BuzzFeed, Univision from events after critical coverage. What do you make of that?
Well, I think it sure like plays to the crowd, and it's funny because when he bans reporters, they're usually actually doing actually very good work. You know, so our Chip Gabriel got banned for writing that Donald Trump had organizational problems in Iowa before the caucuses, and lo and behold, he ended up having debilitating organizational problems in Iowa if you consider losing a problem.
Right. So he bans papers just for any negative story or reporters?
Not any. It's funny. Like you never know which one is going to do is going to set him off because there's plenty of critical coverage. I mean, some people say there could be more, there could be different types, but there is plenty, and not every reporter gets banned. So I don't. Seems pretty particular to the mood of the moment.
But meanwhile, it gets a lot of coverage. He gets way more than any other candidate, and it's pretty much free media exposure that he gets. What do you make of that, that there is this dissonance? So on the campaign trail, he's got this very antagonistic relationship with the reporters, and yet he manages to have so much media access.
Well, I mean, some of it is kind of out of a very old playbook that the Republicans have used for a long time, you know, back to George H.W. Bush, and, you know, annoy the media about Bush. But it's got a more thunderous element to it. So some of it, again, is playing to the crowd because I don't think there's been a presidential candidate of this stature in the polls and in the delegate count who has ever been this close personally with reporters, who has ever spoken to media individually, the heads of the networks he knows very well. He's in New York. He like lives in the media capital, and he's not just any citizen of the media capital, the big, you know, Daddy Warbucks of that capital. So it's a really funny dichotomy.
Right. So
funny is the wrong word.
Yeah. Do you think it's an act that calling reporters disgusting, or does he really believe that?
I think it's a mix of both. I definitely get the sense, and people who know him better than I do say that he has sometimes exhibits a very thin skin. So sometimes he seems to take it personally. Megyn Kelly could be an act. It gives him a sort of plot line for his campaign, but he seems to take great umbrage as she asked him questions about his own past statements.
And Ben, back to you. You've covered other candidates, and you've spent some time on the Sanders campaign as well. How is the experience different covering Trump than the others?
It's almost, where do you start? Most presidential campaigns, especially at this point, will have a big press shop, a team of advisors, sources that you cultivate relationships with, that you socialize with, that can fill you in on things like where the details of where the candidate stands on X, Y, or Z issue. The Trump campaign is basically a skeleton crew other than its advance team. So there's not really a press shop. There's this young woman, Hope Hicks, this is her first job in politics. She worked for Ivanka Trump's fashion line before this. The campaign manager, Corey Lewandowski, is much more involved in the details of dealing with press than you see in other campaigns. He's one of only about three people that's authorized to speak with the press other than the candidate himself. And of course, there's the seething hostility from the candidate when you're sitting in that press pen, and from some, but by no means all, members of the campaign.
Are you afraid for your physical safety when you're at these events?
Not usually. I have had colleagues who have gone out into the crowd and suffered injury. One female reporter who I work alongside was elbowed in the ribs in Miami in October as she waded through a crowd. Obviously, Sopan Deb, CBS, was arrested, mm-hmm. I guess accidentally, and charged with resisting arrest in Chicago, and he suffered some bruises and scrapes. So from time to time, yeah, your flight or fight response kicks in the course of covering this campaign. But that's only in a handful of moments, at least for me.
So are you still banned from Trump events, and how are you going to cover him?
That's a great question. I have no idea if or when they'll start to credential me again. They don't really have any events on their public schedule after today. We have other reporters covering them today. The next time he's out on the trail, I plan to go cover him. And if these are public rallies and they deny me credentials, I'll try to enter as a member of the public. They've removed at least one reporter recently who's gone in as a member of the public at one of these rallies. But if they don't credential me, I'll try that and hope that they don't have me removed from the premises.
And Jim, you wrote today in your column about the television networks, cable and broadcast, just reaping a huge payday for their Trump coverage and changing the rules of the game in terms of how they interview him. Can you talk about that when it comes to the Sunday morning talk shows?
I think the setup to that is that Trump, because he is an incredible ratings draw, singularly a ratings draw, presidential campaigns always tend to do well, right, in the ratings, but he's singularly a ratings draw. It gives him leverage, and he's a deal maker. He uses leverage. So what he's gotten there are a couple of different examples, but yeah, the morning shows, the Sunday public affairs programs, which I personally put in a different category than other shows. Those are some of the oldest shows on television, Face the Nation, Meet the Press, and this is where your candidates came to sit and take their grilling. The audience could see their facial expressions. No aides can slip notes to them because they're in plain view. There's a certain body language. So what Trump convinced all of these major Sunday morning Sunday shows to do, except for one, Fox News Sunday, was to take him on the phone. And they've all had him, except for Fox, on the phone. And he
I think, steamrolls the interviewers. They lose control of the interview, which it's hard to control an interview with Donald Trump anyway, but they give it up that much more. Their audience doesn't get to see him as a candidate in full. And I think that was kind of a compromise. Now, Chuck Todd of Meet the Press told me he's not going to do it anymore. That in the beginning he thought it was he wanted to get Trump on the record for his audience, and he got that, and now it's done. But yesterday morning, George Stephanopoulos at This Week had him on by phone.
Jim Rutenberg, media columnist for The New York Times. Ben Schreckinger, reporter for Politico. Thanks to you both.
Thank you.
Thanks so much.
There was a strange event last night on Fox, The Passion of the Christ, as interpreted by Tyler Perry. Linda Holmes is here to talk about that and other TV news next on Press Play.
This podcast is produced by nonprofit radio station KCRW. KCRW relies on member support to help keep our programming fresh and authentic. Find out how you can donate at kcrw.com/join.
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. With Donald Trump making headlines every day, naturally, the time is right for his second ex-wife to return to network television. Yes, Marla Maples joins the cast of one of ABC's most popular shows. It's time to talk TV. Linda Holmes joins us this week. She writes and edits NPR's entertainment and pop culture blog. It's called Monkey See. Welcome back, Linda.
Oh, thank you so much.
Great to have you. Okay, so before we get to Marla Maples, yesterday was Palm Sunday, so there was this strange mix of musicians on our TVs, including Seal and Trisha Yearwood. And
yes.
So this is a live musical called The Passion.
Yes. And it was put on by and hosted and narrated by Tyler Perry. And it involved a bunch of different elements. I made it about 15 minutes, so I do not in any way pass judgment on the entire thing. I made it up until the part where Peter was singing Home by Philip Phillips as like his thing about the struggle of being Peter and following Jesus. It was just a really unusual format to me. I think from what I saw of the ratings today, they were solid. I don't think they were anything that's going to necessarily mean you're going to see The Passion every year.
Yeah.
But it was in New Orleans. Parts of it were live. Parts of it were not live. It was a very interesting project. Just it got a little strange for me, I have to admit.
Well, we have a clip of tape. I think this is Peter singing.
Hey, weren't you with Jesus of Nazareth?
I don't know what you're talking about.
Jesus of Nazareth.
I swear I don't know that man.
Okay, so it was a strange mix of singing and acting or speaking.
Yeah, I think you have to keep in mind that a lot of people have a lot of different ways of experiencing church. And I think to some people, this felt like a big kind of mega church service to them. And I think if you didn't grow up with these kinds of, I mean, in a lot of churches, there is a lot of incorporating of modern music and stuff like that. And I think maybe if that's not your thing, it might have seemed stranger than it would have if that's kind of the way that you go to church and always go to church. It was an interesting experiment, I thought.
Well, it seems that the networks are digging this live musical event thing.
Right. They are. I think it's partly that. And I think it's also partly the continuing sense that there's a market for things that recognize, the element of faith in a lot of people's lives and what they take in culturally. So I think you saw a combination of a couple of things that networks have been working on trying to get right.
Okay, moving on. Speaking of ratings and music, Dancing with the Stars returns tonight for its 22nd season.
And it's eternal.
Yeah, that is never going to die, much like The Passion. We're going to see it over and over again. So who is lacing up their dancing shoes tonight?
Well, you mentioned Marla Maples, also, who, they've some of the press release stuff involves making sure you know that she's also an actress and all that other stuff. But yes, as you mentioned, one of Donald Trump's ex-wives. Jodie Sweetin, who is on Full House. There are a couple of football players, Geraldo Rivera. As always, it's really a mix of people.
Right. So a mix of people who are, you know, not to be too uncharitable, but not the A-listers.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's always such a weird, depending on who you are, you know, very accomplished football players are A-list in their own way,
yeah.
If that makes sense.
Uh-huh.
It's just, they just don't tend to be celebrities who are the most famous people you ever heard of.
Right. So I guess it will never run out of stars to dance?
I don't think it'll ever run out of stars. And the funny thing is you can see over time that they have identified some of these areas where they can draw people from that kind of continue to give and give and give, whether it's professional athletes. Every time there's a set of Olympics now, it's, you know, there have been several cases of like people from the Olympics, or they'll get people from reality shows. Kim Fields, who used to be on Facts of Life and is also now in one of the Real Housewives franchises, is also on it this season. So they draw from reality shows. They draw from the kind of Disney tween kind of entertainment world. So they have now these kind of slots that they fill every year. Some of them are kind of, I mean, I would consider Marlon Maples a little bit of a wild card in that regard. But some of them are slots that they kind of fill every year now because they've figured out what works for them.
Right. So wasn't Sarah Palin's daughter Bristol on it as well?
Yes, she sure was.
Political?
Yep.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
People who are people who are adjacent to politics in some way.
Right. So.
And Tom DeLay. Also.
Oh, okay. He wasn't just adjacent. He was
exactly
in the center of it.
Yeah.
Yeah. So what do you think is the staying power? What accounts for it?
You know, that's a great question. When I first started watching Dancing with the Stars, it was so goofy, but every now and then you would get somebody. Emmett Smith, the football player, was a great example of this early on, where somebody would actually become a really good dancer. And it was really fun. It's really fun watching people become good at something, particularly if they start off with, you know, maybe a lot of talent, but not a lot of, you know, polish or knowledge. It's fun to watch people learn to do things. And then at the same time, if you pick the right people, and I think that's why they keep coming back to these kind of casting patterns, if you pick the right people, you know, you get a certain number of people who just want to kind of see what it looks like to see Geraldo Rivera dancing.
Okay. Different strokes for different folks.
Uh-huh.
Let's move on. There's another medical drama premiering tomorrow. It's called Heartbeat on NBC.
Yeah.
And really, it seems like we can't get enough of these medical dramas. Grey's Anatomy still on the air after 12 seasons.
Well, here's the thing. Not everybody is Grey's Anatomy. It's very important when you see a show that is part of a larger genre to recognize that the shows that survive in that genre tend to be particularly good examples of it. Grey's Anatomy is although it has plenty of problems at different times, Grey's Anatomy is a really solidly made show.
Mm-hmm.
And you can't just put a bunch of sexy people in a hospital and think it's going to be Grey's Anatomy, because I am here to tell you, Heartbeat is not Grey's Anatomy. And when you just throw a bunch of people into a story and you use a lot of tropes about, you know, a tough, difficult, but ultimately good-hearted, well-meaning doctor, it's really easy to just kind of drive into a ditch, which they kind of do with this one.
So, miss. Give it a miss.
Did not like it. Mm. Did not like it. Watched the first 2.5, roughly. Did not like it. Was not my thing.
Well,
Melissa George, who's...
Yeah, you stayed longer than 15 minutes, though, so...
Yeah, that is true. Melissa George, who's the star, who you may have seen in a few other things, is a... I think has some difficulty with making much out of this lead character, who's just kind of a selfish jerk. And then, but it's the selfish jerk doctor, which is kind of a staple of House and some other shows. But there's not a lot to her. She just kind of seems like a bad doctor. I don't know.
Okay.
I wouldn't go to her.
All right. We won't go to her. We won't watch her. She's done. Thank you, Linda Holmes.
Thank you so much.
Linda Holmes writes and edits NPR's entertainment and pop culture blog. It's called Monkey See. It is so nice to see Jolie Myers back.
It's me.
Hi.
I'm here.
Welcome back.
Whoop, whoop. And I'm here and I have really good ideas.
Excellent.
I brought some ideas back with me.
Let's hear them.
How to refresh Dancing with the Stars.
Yeah. Does it need a refresher? First of all, it's got Geraldo Rivera.
I think you just answered your own question. Politics edition. We get Mitt Romney, Mitch McConnell, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, and Mayor Garcetti on there.
All dancing together?
Are they the stars or are the choreographers the stars at that point? I also have another idea. Animal edition. Famous animal edition. We have Grumpy Cat, those llamas that got loose in Arizona last year.
Yes.
Oh, yes. Yes. And P22, the mountain lion, Madeline, dancing with the animal stars.
It might be eating with the animals, too,
oh,
unfortunately.
P22 just goes crazy. We also had a suggestion from one of our Twitter followers. Brooke tweets that she wants to see a Joss Whedon version with the cast of Buffy and Angel, and of course, hijinks would ensue.
Okay, thank you. If you have any ideas at all for refreshing Dancing with the Stars, please hit us up on Twitter at KCRW Press Play or Facebook, KCRW Press Play. Jolie Myers, thank you.
Of course.
I'm Madeline Brand, and that's it for this edition of Dancing with Press Play. I'll see you tomorrow.